may we nurture joy.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for inviting me here. And special thanks to Lorraine and Linda for helping make me feel welcome. So thank you. And helping with the setup. I'm just going to give you a little bit of background about the Migrant Quilt Project, and then I'm going to go into a PowerPoint presentation. But it's so ironic that my journey started here near Sierra Vista with the Quilt Project. I was up in the Huachuca Mountains camping in 2005 and hiking all around the area and bird watching. And I noticed a layup site, what we refer to as a campsite of migrants. And there were many belongings left there, baby bottles. I remember seeing diapers, clothing, backpacks, water bottles. And I was horrified. I mean, I was so upset that people were leaving things in the desert like this. And at the same time, I was wondering why they were bringing a baby across. And so I am a naturally curious person. And so after that weekend, I started reading about the issues going on between Mexico and the U.S. and migration. And I also started volunteering for Humane Borders and putting water out in the desert and cleaning up these migrant campsites. And you know, I was so curious about this whole migratory pattern that was coming through the Tucson sector that in 2007 I decided to take a backpacking trip to Central America and Mexico, and we started in El Salvador. But prior to leaving, I clipped the names of women who had died in the Tucson sector and did a lot of research before I left and found the little communities where they were from. And I focused my trip on going to meet these families of these women who died in the Tucson sector. And so I'm going to tell you the story of three women who I was able to meet their family members and who also had a story to tell from the Tucson sector. Now, I still collect these stories in some. You know, perhaps one day I'm going to be able to write a book about this, the root causes of migration is the way I understand it. So going back after the return of my trip, we were cleaning up these campsites and layup sites, and I came across this clothing. And I decided that maybe we should do something important with the clothing and incorporate it into names quilts, like the AIDS quilts. And so the Tucson, or the Migrant Quilt Project, was born in around 2007, and by 2008 we had our first quilt made. And we have almost all the quilts completed, of course, except for the one that I'm working on. I felt like I needed to help with a quilt, but I am not a quilter, so that's why I asked if the church here would want to help me create it, and then of course you get credit for it. Every time the quilt travels, you're named on there as well. So these are the things that I found when traveling through El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and throughout many small villages in Mexico, all the way up to the northern border. And I'm going to begin by, someone get the lights, please. This was working. I will let you know, too, that there are some graphic photos in here. And I will warn you before I show them, but there is one graphic photo of a woman named Prudencia. And I wrestle with the idea of including it in the PowerPoint, but if we don't include it, we don't really see what happens to the bodies in the deserts. So this is the Migrant Quilt Project and the Immigration Equipment. I'm going to be telling you the story of these three women, Prudencia Martinez Gomez from Todos Santos, Guatemala, Yolanda Gonzalez Garcia from a very small village in Oaxaca, And Lucrecia Dominguez, she's from near a small town near Zacatecas, Mexico. I'm going to give you a little context of what I found when I went to Guatemala. And some context regarding what I understood took place there. That fueled immigration. So President Jacobo Arbenz was the president back in the 1950s, and he was like a socialist, and he wanted to create policies that took away the land that the United Fruit Company had absconded with to build grow systems and harvest bananas and all of that, and return it to peasant farmers, because that land, he thought, was really the land of the farmers. So the U.S. spread propaganda at that time in the 1950s, saying that there's a red infection, that this really is a communist takeover, and that they were spreading rumors that, you know, President Arbenz was trying to create a communist society, and that they needed to be dealt with. So in 1954, the United States engineered a coup d'etat, ousting President Arbenz. What unfolded in May and June of 1954 is now a familiar story in the U.S. intelligence and diplomatic history. Washington used the CIA as U.S. Ambassador John Purfoy to support and direct Guatemalan leaders in overthrowing Arbenz's government. It was very much a psychological warfare. And they were spreading rumors that a major force was steadily moving toward the nation's capital. And it so unnerved Arbenz and others that the government fell without much of a battle at all. What did happen was, it split the country between paramilitary leaders who supported the Arbenz overthrow, and they were backed by the United States, and the indigenous people of the Mayan people. At least 250,000 people were killed during this time, most of them indigenous Mayan. There's a photograph of some of the bodies. But in 1982, Todos Santos, a village up in the mountains where Prudencia came from, was massacred. Thousands of people were killed. That village was burned down in 1982, and subsequently, many of the people in that village were forced, the men were forced to join the paramilitary group, or flee to the mountainous regions where they lived and sustained themselves off of roots and fruits and things like that. Prudencia came from this small village in Todos Santos. This is actually a photo of her small village. In 2007, 19-year-old Prudencia embarked on her deadly odyssey from Todos Santos, Guatemala, to Oakland, California. She was hoping to join her boyfriend, Ismael, who had previously left Todos Santos. The day she died, it was on June 15th, just a couple of days ago, 2007. It marks 10 years that she's been gone. And, I won't forget that. Prudencia actually wasn't a casualty of war, but instead a victim of the devastating consequences that came after. Families remain divided, communities are still in chaos, and lack of trust for one another creates divisive animosity among the Mayas, especially those families who had ties to the war. Christopher Andrew, a scholar on the history of U.S. intelligence, states the Guatemalan affair was a disreputable moment. Eisenhower was directly responsible for death and destruction, yet showed no signs of embarrassment then or later of the bullying of a banana republic. Ismael, who was Prudencia's boyfriend, had left earlier. He had to leave and left this village because he couldn't find work as a teacher. Because his father's involvement in the Civil War, his father decided to join the U.S.-backed military and ended up dividing his family in the area. It was either that or be killed. And some of the murders that occurred there were very, very violent and vicious. And so his father decided to join the military. So because of that, Ismael wasn't able to teach in his village, even though he was college trained to teach. He was not welcome in the community, but before he left, he had met Prudencia, and they had formed a relationship. Prudencia decided to leave her village in pursuit of Ismael. She was going to surprise him for his birthday in Oakland, California. And this is the area where she died, which is about 10 miles west of Tucson, near Trico. There's an electrical company out there. And so this is the area. The next one, this is where her body was found. The next picture will be a picture of Prudencia. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it will be a picture of her body as found in the desert. And this is one of the priests that held a service there. We all had gone out to that area where she died and had a formal service for her. So now's the time to look away. This is how Prudencia's body was found. As you can tell, she was eaten and scavenged by many animals. This happened just 10 miles west of Tucson. I struggle whether to put that picture up because I don't think we understand really the dust without actually witnessing it ourselves. And you can look around here, there's been thousands of those same stories of people who have died. And this next story is about Yolanda Gonzalez Garcia, who in 2000 left her home state or home village in Oaxaca, up in a very, very small village in Mexico. She traveled with her 18-month-old daughter, Elizama, and Yolanda herself was 18 years old when she left. The North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico began on January 1st, 1994. It brought the immediate elimination of tariffs on more than one-half of U.S. imports from Mexico and more than one-third U.S. exports to Mexico. Many argue that it has had negative impacts on farmers in Mexico, who saw food prices fall based on subsidized imports from U.S. agribusiness. And while I was visiting Yolanda's family, I met her mother, Paula, and Elizama, and she, in fact, told me that, you know, they used to be bean farmers, and they would travel around that small village and grow beans. And after she couldn't say the word NAFTA, she didn't know it was a North American Free Trade Policy that has created this problem. But she said, you know, the United States is sending us beans now. And, you know, so she was able to clearly tell me the causes of the elimination of jobs in her small village. So they had been bean farmers. Cheaper beans were being sold in these small market villages throughout Mexico. Latin Americans used to subsist off these small farms, community farms, and they would take their subsidies or whatever they had left after feeding their families to these open marketplaces. And this is a place in Malacatan, Guatemala, where they would trade items for other items that they needed. So migration to the U.S. from Mexico increased dramatically after NAFTA was implemented. And we know that because the architects of NAFTA closed all the borders that same year. Operation Safekeeper, Gatekeeper, and Operation Hold the Line closed off those urban areas and forced migrants into remote areas where they believed death by deterrence would solve the problem. So they are directly complicit in the deaths in the desert. Yolanda is pictured at the top. She decided to leave her impoverished village to meet with her husband in the U.S. where he was able to find work. So she and Elizama began the trek to the United States in 2000, despite her mother Paula's insistence to stay, and that is Paula there. This is Elizama. I believe Elizama at this time was 9 years old. That was 10 years ago, so she's now 19. With only a few ounces of water in Yolanda's water jug, she filled up Elizama's water bottle before she lay down and died on the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation, just about less than 10 miles in from the Mexican border. They continue to struggle in that small village due to lack of farming opportunities in Mexico. According to the USDA Ag Report by David Williams, they looked at a 10-year study and commented, wrote a white paper about the effects of NAFTA on Mexico. And what they found was economic transition away from farming is necessary for 85% of the farmers in Mexico. Only 15% of those farmers are globally competitive. The remainder need to find other jobs. So we have actually displaced those small-scale farmers who had subsisted for centuries on their land. This is a woman from the same village who is a friend of Paula's. Millions of Latin Americans leave their home to seek a wage in a country that is unequivocally responsible for the loss of jobs. This is Paula's little store that she has in her home. They sell sundry items, mostly candies, to children in the area. They're too poor also to buy Yolanda a headstone. I did go to where she is buried there. The other thing I wanted to point out is that Paula has to sleep on some palm fronds just below where her little table is with her sundry of items, so that she can, you know, chase off any kind of people who are going to steal from her. So, you know, she sleeps on the ground on palm fronds. This story is Lucrecia's story. Lucrecia is from the Zacatecas, Mexico area. Lucrecia's journey through the hostile Sonoran Desert still resonates with many in the Tucson sector along the international border between Arizona and Mexico. Gracia was 35 when she left to join her husband. She was carrying two children in tow, and they were headed to Texas. Her 7-year-old daughter Nora and her 15-year-old son Jesus were with her. They were heading to Texas, where her husband found a job and was working the American dream. So, according to her father, Cesario Dominguez, Gracia died in her son's arms somewhere in the Syrian desert on the Tohono O'odham Nation, a reservation equivalent in geographic size to that of Connecticut. This is a Humane Borders death map pinpointing with a single red dot, and some of them are covered up by more red dots, so very saturated. And we see the majority of the deaths do occur on the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation, and that's because of lack of water, lack of Samaritan aid. And it's where they funnel migrants into these remote parts along the Baba Kivri Mountain. So we see a number of deaths happening. So after about 19 hours, Jesus left his mother near an embankment of an arroyo to find help. When Jesus was finally spotted by Border Patrol, he had told agents that his mom was back there, left behind. And they did not listen to him. They did not allow him to take the Border Patrol agents to the body. Instead, they expedited him in what they referred to as immediate deportation. This is a photograph of Mike Wilson, who is a Tohono O'odham, and he puts water on the reservation. So, many of you might know the story of Doris Meisner, but she was a former commissioner of Immigration and Naturalization Service. She told the Arizona Republic that her agency knew the crackdown in San Diego, Arizona, Texas would push migrants into these mountains and deserts to the east. She knew that would happen, yet they would be deterred from crossing by the harsh conditions there. We did believe that geography would be an ally to us. It was our sense that the number of people crossing the border through Arizona would go down to a trickle once people realized what it's like. Well, we have not seen that go down to a trickle. We've just seen nearly 3,000 people just die in the Tucson sector alone. From the late 1980s through the early 90s, the number of border crossing deaths were minimal, but from the late 1990s through 2008, the number of deaths spiked to over 100 per year. The majority of the increase in deaths during this period occurred within the Border Patrol's Tucson sector. As you can see here, up to the point of 1994, 1995, there was just a very small number of deaths that occurred. And then with the closures of Operation Gatekeeper, Hold the Line, and Safeguard, these urban areas, the numbers went drastically up. And this is trying to find out what the report was from, but I don't have it on there. So the primary discernible effect of the strategy based on INS apprehension statistics appears to be a shifting of illegal alien traffic into remote regions where no food, water, or medical aid is available. When Lucrecia lost consciousness, Jesus struck out alone to find emergency help. 3 days later, Border Patrol agents found him lost, wandering and disoriented in the desert. Although Jesus was dehydrated, in shock, suffering from heat exhaustion, and terrified about his mother's status, the agents gave him little water and left him in the federal line in Nogales, Sonora, a practice known as expedited removal. Once there, Jesus placed a frantic call to his grandfather, Cesario, for help. The following 3 weeks, Cesario was able to get a humanitarian visa to come and find his daughter in the desert. He hiked the area that Jesus thought was where he had left his mom's body, and they would converse daily on the phone, and he would describe the landscape to his grandfather. And there were other people who participated. Novordes helped out with some of the searches as well. But the Border Patrol helped one day. Cesario found 3 bodies before he found the remains of his daughter. This is a sculpture done by Debbie McCullough, a local Tucson artist who creates art, sometimes out of migrant belongings, sometimes not. But this tells the story of Lucrecia. So the humanitarian group Novordes assisted him. Miraculously, Cesario eventually came upon his daughter's skeletal remains, recognizing her 3 rings. What was left was that hand with those rings there in the sand, said her father. So the Migrant Quilt Project believes that U.S. policies have contributed drastically to the immigration crisis and to all the deaths in the desert. We believe that we need to honor all those who died in telling their stories so we can support humane immigration reform for all migrants attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. So, that's about the end of it, but we really believe that if you can't understand the root causes of migration, then it's not really possible to understand the humanitarian crisis. So through these visual quilts and the loss of lives, we believe that by memorializing all the deaths in the deserts and giving people a name and honoring their struggle, that we can shift perceptions to a more human, kind, loving, compassionate policy making. So that's really the end of it. And if anybody has any questions, happy to answer, or if our time's up, maybe you can talk to me afterwards.
Thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, well, thank you. So, yeah, you can ask me afterwards, but thank you.